All in the Mind on ABC Radio National, Natasha Mitchell. Hello there. Our recent interview with Kay Redfield Jamison about the loss of her husband really struck a chord with many of you, particularly her reflections on the intensity and untidiness of grief. Here's a reminder.
People, when they grieve, often want to know, you know, am I depressed? Is there something psychiatrically wrong with me? Or am I just missing someone? You know, is it, how long should it take? I mean, one of the things that people don't emphasize, I mean, I go wild when people start talking about stages of grief because I have no concept of what that means.
This really is Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's legacy.
Well, I think it's pretty simplistic. You know, I suspect she thought that toward the end of her life. But I mean, you know, it's, by and large, there's nothing very tidy or predictable about grief. But one thing that's particularly unpredictable is how long it's going to last. And people vary enormously. And I think nobody is prepared for how long it lasts. It takes a very long time to deal with the death of someone you love. And I think that's a good thing because you don't lose the relationship. Grief allows you to continue a relationship with someone. It just forces you to change the nature of that relationship.
Professor of Psychiatry and psychologist Kay Redfield Jamison speaking about her new book Nothing Was the Same on the show a few weeks ago. Well, one listener in response to Kay wrote to me recalling an interview she'd heard with the Swiss psychiatrist Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. It was aired on ABC TV back in the 1970s on a show called Monday Conference, presented by the much-loved Robert Moore. And so, curious too, we dug into the archives, and hey presto. The year is 1978.
On Monday Conference this week, Learning to Live with Death, with Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross.
And the occasion is Dr. Kubler-Ross's first tour to Australia. Kubler-Ross is most famous for her 1969 book On Death and Dying, in which she described five psychological stages of dying, and later she applied them to grief. They included denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. And her ideas resonated with countless many trying to make sense of their own loss, and very much inspired the modern hospice and palliative care movement. But as you heard from Kay just now, some strongly argued her thinking was too prescriptive and her science, or lack of it perhaps, questionable. Like journalist Ron Rosenbaum, in a gripping criticism of her legacy in Slate, wrote that she became a saintly icon, the queen of death, and that her five stages gave an illusion of control over the uncontrollable, a deeply embedded, unexamined ideology of death. Well, in the book called On Grief and Grieving that Elizabeth finished with David Kessler in the year of her own death, 2004, she tried to clarify some of the misunderstandings about her five stages and said they were never meant to tuck messy emotions into neat packages. There's no typical response to loss, as there is not typical loss. Our grief is as individual as our lives. So look, it's with some hesitation I dug into the archives, and there are places Kubler-Ross went in the extended version of this interview, perhaps too kooky for my science sensibility, the afterlife and reincarnation and the like, but as an historical adventure, sure to provoke a response from you, here's Monday Conference, 1978, and what is it about old archives that makes everyone sound so quaint?
For something as inevitable and deeply personal as death, most of us spend remarkably little time talking about it or even thinking openly about it. It's a common human need to be counselled and comforted in the presence of death, our own or that of somebody else. But how many of us even know where to begin, or are truly confident of what we might say and do, or are sure that we're not ruled by our fears and superstitions? Obviously, we can learn little about coping with death, dying, and grief unless we talk about it, and that's what we're going to do this week. Our guest has a growing international reputation as a pioneer in the techniques of caring for the dying and their families. Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross is a psychiatrist, now working mainly in the United States. Arising out of her experiences in hospitals, particularly, Dr. Kubler-Ross has written a number of books, including On Death and Dying and Death, the Final Stage of Growth. Although this is her first visit to Australia for a series of workshops and lectures, Dr. Kubler-Ross's fame has certainly preceded her. Dr. Ross, I suspect that you know better than I do, but I know now, that a lot of people are not going to watch this program tonight because it's dealing with death. You don't have to be very brave to produce television programs dealing with sex or politics or religion, but death somehow turns off a lot of people. What is it, and I suspect they're the ones who should most watch the program, unfortunately, but what is it that we're really, really, really frightened of when it comes to death?
If you try to ask people what they're really afraid of, they always come up with the same answers. They say they're afraid of the unknown. They're afraid of punishment after death. They're afraid of suffering, of pain, of leaving small children behind. You can go to any city in the world, practically, you get the same answers. But what they're really afraid of, is they don't say.
Yes, that's what I'm asking.
Because it is repressed and it is unconscious. And it is the fear of your own destructiveness, yes, of your own negativity. It's very individually different. If people who have come to grips with their own negativities and have no more negativity within themselves, no more fear, guilt, and shame, they're never afraid of death and dying.
Are you afraid of death yourself?
No.
Were you ever?
I'm sure I was when I was younger to some degree.
Do you know why or at what stage you changed from being frightened of death to
It's not something that you lose overnight. It's a very slow, gradual process. When you do your own growth work and get in touch with your own fears, whatever they are, and begin to get rid of them. And especially when you work with dying children, which is my most favorite aspect of this work, if you really love them and get involved with them, you cannot possibly be afraid of death and dying anymore.
Dr. Ross, I wonder if we could come straight away to what I suppose is the central concept in what I've read of what you've written about death and dying. That's the stages of dying: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. But are those stages necessarily in that order?
No. Now, that's one of the biggest mistakes people make. They read a book that you only put together for teaching purposes. Number one, you have to know that the stages of dying have nothing to do with dying. I mean, it's obvious. Anybody who goes through a loss, if you lose a boyfriend or a girlfriend or a mate, or you're in separation or divorce, or you lose a job or a pet, or some people only, if they lose their contact lenses, go through the same stages. So it's a very human reaction to a crisis, to a loss. And naturally, human beings are not robots. They don't follow a book, fortunately. They are in two or three stages together, or they skip stages. Most important for those of you who want to help dying patients is that you never, ever try to push people through the stages of dying with the illusion that you're a good therapist or a good priest or a good anybody. If all your patients die in a stage of peace and acceptance, that would be horrible, and that's what a lot of people think.
How many patients, in your experience, would die in the stage of acceptance?
Most of them, but that should not be your goal. That happens anyway if you do a good job, but that should never be your expectation. To die with dignity does not mean to die in peace and acceptance. To die with dignity should be your goal, and to me that means to be allowed to die in character. Do you know what I mean by
no,
to die in character? The problem with denial is that 9 out of 10 people who are sent to me, as this patient is in denial, are not in denial. This is an illusion. When you look at them and see who needs denial, it is not the dying patient, it is the physician or the nurse or the family. And that's the primary need in this work, is that you can be honest with yourself. Because if you need denial, the patient will maintain denial to protect you out of fear that if he shakes you up or if he makes you uncomfortable, that you're going to desert him. And that is the biggest fear of dying patients, is that they're going to be deserted. if they make you uncomfortable. And so they play the game. And they die in pseudo-denial because of our fear. There are more and more young people now who are healthy fighters and rebels. And for them to die with dignity means to die, to fight to the end. And they're giving you a hard time. And I love them. And most people would sedate them so they're nice and quiet and meek. And to me, that's very sad.
But just so I'm clear on this, because this does throw a light on my misreading, then, of quite a lot of what you've written. And I've got to admit, it was a misreading, then. As far as you're concerned, there's nothing particularly more ethically valuable in one stage rather than another. It's just whatever suits you. If you're a denier, well, then you should die in a stage of denial in order to be true to yourself. And if you're an angry person, then it's anger, is it?
If you love people and accept them where they are at, and do not try to push them into your molds and your needs, then you love them unconditionally, without hooks attached. You're a good patient if, you know, to me that is just gratifying your own needs. If you can do that, then patients usually move through the stages anyway, but that should not be your primary goal. I hope I make this clear.
Yes. Is someone who'd like to take up any point we've raised so far, or... Yes, thank you.
Dr. Ross, I think we find in our Western society there comes a time in people's lives when they have an incurable illness and the doctor comes out and say it's a husband and wife. He'll speak to the husband and say, your wife, I can't do anything more for her and she perhaps only has 3 weeks or 3 months to live. And the husband then says to the family, we'll keep this from her. And they do. Now, the wife, after a while, it may be a husband, will invariably get to the stage where they will know that they're not getting better and they know they're going to die, and they'll say, I'm not going to tell my husband because it will only upset him. Now, this game goes on, and actually, when they come to actually dying, we try to tell them to share this because it's a very intimate time in their lives, and often they just won't because they feel they just can't do it. I'm asking you to talk about this to support me because it can make death a very beautiful thing, although it's still sad.
You can only make death a beautiful, memorable, beautiful experience if you're honest and if you share it at the beginning. And the earlier you inform a patient about the potentially terminal illness, the more they have time to come to grips with it, to finish unfinished business, and to share this as a family experience. I'm very opposed to tell the family and not the patient. I think that's deceitful, that's dishonest, and that prevents the patient from living to the very end and to do all the things that they would have liked to do. And we always include the children. Another thing you mentioned is, you tell a husband that the wife has 3 weeks or 3 months to live. I always warn people not to do that because it's never right. It is not helpful. There are some, mainly young men, who have a terminal illness who ask a physician, how long do I have? And that's for very practical reasons. Maybe they just started a new business. And if they actually knew how little time they had, they would have to rearrange their business. We had a surgeon at our hospital who did a very beautiful job. He only when he was pushed to give time, he would say, well, if you insist on knowing, 50% have 6 months, 25% have so and so many months, 10% have so and so many months. And when you add it up, the percentage, it always added up to 99%. And the patients were very shrewd. Said, hey, wait a minute, what's with the other 1%? And Dr. Boharska would say, that's the 1% for hope. And he was the most beloved physician who knew not only the science of medicine, but the art of medicine. And he never had problems with his patients. And I think that's what we have to teach again. But to be playing games, to me, is criminal. Patients know anyway that they're dying, even if you don't tell them. And if the physicians don't tell the patients, I can give you some dirty tricks how you can get the patients to tell you. I'm very good at that.
Dr. Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, author of the influential On Death and Dying. In front of a live audience in the ABC studios in 1978, yes, a trip down memory lane here on ABC Radio National's All in the Mind with me, Natasha Mitchell. In ears everywhere via Radio Australia and podcast. Let's head back to the ABC icon, Robert Moore.
Dr. Ross, you've said that if we're to change society's attitudes towards death, we must begin with the children,
yes.
Because not only are they the best pupils, but the best teachers, I heard
yes.
you say that. Why? What makes you say that?
The longer we live, the more phony people become. And I don't mean this in a derogatory way, but I do in a way. Children are the only really genuine, honest people. And by the time they're 6, 7 years old, they already become phony balonies. Because we teach them to do that. That is part of being polite, quote, unquote. To use examples about death and dying. A child's mommy is dying, and the child asks, what's happening to mommy? Well, don't worry, she's going to be all right. Well, she may be in the hospital already dying. And then when it comes very close to death, and the child picks up that mommy may be dying, and asks questions, very quickly the grown-ups come and say, oh, your mommy's going to heaven, implying she's going to be all right, she's going to live in a place where there is no pain, no suffering, and the children would be okay, except the next day when mommy dies. The grown-ups carry on like the greatest tragedy has happened. But what happens then to your heaven, where it's so beautiful? Our behavior belies our words. When you listen to young children, who are not so defensive yet and have not piled up so much pain and fear and guilt and shame and unfinished business. Young children are beautiful. They tell you in 1 minute that they're dying, and they tell you what their unfinished business is, and they share with you very beautifully. If they only had a grown-up who can do that, who doesn't make a nightmare out of it. The other thing about children in contrast to grown-ups is that all of us know that we are dying and when we are dying, when we have an illness, whether you're informed or not, but it's on a pre-conscious level. And children, awareness and knowledge of their impending death is much more on the surface, and so you can ask a child to draw a picture, which takes 5 minutes at the most, and the child tells you not only that they are terminally ill, but when they're going to die. Those are children who have never been informed, for example, that they have an inoperable brain tumor, and it's in the picture already that they're going to die at age 8. And if you know this symbolic language, then you can talk to those children about it, and they're very grateful and very open, and they teach you.
How common is it for people to know when they're going to die?
How common?
How common is it that some...
Terribly common. Every nurse here knows that. You go and visit an old lady, and you say, I will try to visit you again at Christmas, and she takes a ring off your finger and says, I want you to have that. And they say, oh, don't do that. If you still want to give it to me, you can give it to me at Christmas. And they just shake their head, and you know that you're not going to see them at Christmas, and they die before Christmas. Every nurse has had cases like this.
Yes, on the aisle, that's right.
You did say earlier that I understand that you really meant that if somebody is against acceptance of death at a time when he knows he's dying, that if you're counselling him, you should not argue him into accepting death. In other words, you go along the way he does. But to a question about euthanasia, voluntary euthanasia, you seem to go the other way. In other words, if somebody really wants, knows he's dying and he wants to do away with himself, then you are now saying the counsellor should argue him out of it. Isn't that right?
No. That's not right. If somebody wants to be killed, and I'm using blunt language, so I'm sure that we're not playing games. If somebody wants to be killed who has a terminal illness, I cannot talk them out of hanging themselves. But if I really care for that human being, I ask them what is so unbearable that they'd rather commit suicide. To give an example. And then they tell you that they don't want to live totally dependent, in agony and pain, waiting every 4 hours to get an injection, and between being totally doped up and like a zombie, and then when they are conscious again, they climb the wall in pain, and they have a nurse come with a syringe behind the back and says, do you think you can hold out another 20 minutes? I would not like to exist that way. Then I have to do something about the cause of this agonizing existence. My patients I take home to die. If they don't want any more treatment, that's fine with me. It is their choice. I would never talk somebody into being hooked up on all sorts of machines. I'm very opposed to an endless prolongation of suffering just so they have another 2 months of agony. That I'm very opposed to. But that has to be the patient's choice. If the patient wants no more chemotherapy, that's fine with me. Even if the chemotherapy may enable them to live another 6 months, it is their choice how the quality of their life. But it is my job as a physician and as a specialist for dying patients to help them to live at the absolute maximum fullest until they die. And then I give patients the choice, would you like to go home? And they go home, we move, we always make the bedroom in a living room for some reason. Almost every patient like to be in a living room rather than in a bedroom. And we have them on Brompton mixtures so they're physically comfortable. They can look out in their garden. The children are coming in and out. We ask them what music they loved. Young people like John Denver music, country music. So we have country music playing. We bring flowers in. If they have been on a horrible diet, if they're dying for a hamburger, we bring them a hamburger. Or if they want a beer or a whiskey sour, by golly, they're going to have a beer or a whiskey sour. Do you understand it under those circumstances that people don't want to be killed? That is my practical experience. But I'll try to find out what makes them ask for a termination of their life. And we just didn't have people who needed that.
A lot of people do insist on it. And they go to all sorts of lengths in order to obtain drugs, in order to do away themselves, because they feel that life is no longer worth living. Now, I don't think one should argue them or try very hard to argue them out of that if it's impossible.
I do not argue with my patients.
Dr. Ross, what does the way we conduct our funerals say about our general approach to death and dying?
Not too sure about the funerals in Australia, but in America...
They'll be much the same.
I think you're a little bitty better.
Yeah, maybe. Yes. A few years behind, some people might think.
Not behind, but I think you're ahead.
Not in the value judgment, just in terms of the inevitable.
I think you use a few pounds less of makeup. In the United States, it's very extreme. And I'm not objective about that. I must say I'm from Switzerland, where we have no embalming and no makeup and no slumber rooms, and we don't put lipstick on a dead man's lips. And I'm very prejudiced for that. I like things to be natural and normal and not phony. In the United States, you use tremendous makeup, and you have slumber rooms, and people look so unreal, like you wouldn't believe it.
What, to suggest they're simply sleeping? Is that the...
Yeah.
Slumber room, huh?
Yeah, slumber rooms is usually where you sleep. And they have...
That's avoiding
lipstick
issue, isn't it?
On a man's lips, I mean. It feeds into the need to deny the reality of death. You do need funerals. It is very important that you understand that we are not against funerals. We need rituals. We need closure. But we don't have to make it that expensive and that unrealistic. The viewing of the body is something I want to say something about. The viewing of the body is mandatory in a sudden death. In a slow, lingering death, it is not important because hopefully you have come to grips with the reality that your loved one has died. But in a sudden death, where like your child goes to school and then you're called to go to a hospital emergency room and the team works frantically behind closed doors and you're not allowed to go in. And it's a terrible nightmare for families because there is nobody usually there to brief you up what's happening. And then somebody comes out and says, your son is dead. And you sedate, I don't know if you do that here in the United States, those families are instantly sedated. and you sign the papers and you ship them out of the hospital as fast as possible. This is criminal because that breeds psychopathology. Our ideal way of handling that is that you never ever sedate families. Let them scream. Take them into a tiny little screaming room next to the emergency room. You should have all the soundproof little screaming room in every hospital. Not only for families who have been informed about the sudden death of a loved one, but for the nurses. And then you encourage the family to view the body right there and then. And we prevent families from doing that. It's because of our fear and our discomfort, and we should be honest about that. If you have a suicide or a mutilated death, you bandage the patient up like a post-operative patient. People have been allowed to view the loved one, right? Their grief resolution is far better than anything that you can do afterwards. The only people who stay in a partial denial for years and years and years are people who have lost a loved one in a sudden death where they never saw the body. In the United States, the Vietnam victims, where the family was informed that their son died in Vietnam and there was never a body shipped back. Or you have plane crashes, I presume, and you never have a body. Those people always remain in a partial denial.
Have you yourself ever felt angry towards or guilt towards a patient who was dying or had died? As the phrase goes, died on you, as I read in one of your books, as if...
Well, I've been angry with many of my patients. I mean, some of them are really obnoxious. But they're not any different than any of you.
No. No,
it's an odd question.
I was looking for more than that, actually.
Patients are like you and I. They're not a different breed.
No, but you have quoted...
They make you mad.
You have quoted nurses and doctors as speaking of a patient who had died on them, as if the patient had done it deliberately, just to annoy them.
You will only have this anguish if you cannot accept the reality of death. If, like, physicians have this very often because they're trained in such a one-sided way. They're trained to cure, to treat, to prolong life. That's their main emphasis of their years and years of training. And they're trained in the science of medicine, but not in the art of medicine. And naturally then, when one patient after the other dies, they begin to feel like they're a failure. Damn it, another one died on me.
That's it.
Physicians also have to be trained how to be physicians to patients who are not going to get well. And all of them ultimately are going to die on them anyway. And that's okay. And only when that's okay, when you feel I do the very best I can, and if they're not getting well, I'm a marvelous physician if I do not desert them. If you really feel inside that this is okay, that this is also being a physician, then you will never have that feeling again, he died on me. Does that answer it?
Yes, indeed it does. Dr. Ross, thank you very much indeed for joining us. I know you're very tired after a long flight, so we'll let you off. There'll be another Monday conference next week. Till then, goodbye.
This edition of Monday Conference has come from Sydney. Our guest was Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, author of...
Elizabeth Kubler-Ross there in 1978 with iconic ABC presenter Robert Moore, who in fact died himself from a sudden heart attack the year after that was recorded. I'm sure many practices and thoughts have changed around death in the three decades since. What do you think? And I've also put up a link to a health report interview from 2002 by my colleague Norman Swan, which responds to some of Kubler-Ross's original thinking on death and bereavement on the All in the Mind website. I think that'll interest you. You can add your comments on the All in the Mind blog, or now even easier to do it directly on the All in the Mind website. Click on the heading of this week's show and look for Add Your Comments, abc.net.au/rn/All in the Mind. For that, audio, transcript, further references, and you can catch me on Twitter at All in the Mind. Thanks to co-producer Anita Barrow. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Next week, diving into dolphin heads.